Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of Bigfoot Notes from the Field. I'm your host, William Jebning. I have Jay and TW on this evening. They are both regional directors for the JRG, Jay for the Southeast, TW is for the Southwest. Going to discuss, as we brought up at the end of last week's show, some of the vindictive kinds of behaviors that Sasquatches seem to exhibit. I was going to do a little research and try to dig up some of that, but you know, when you start getting into some of those accounts, and I have tons of them, it gets to be a little daunting. I mean, it's one of those things, you know, you do is for book research because you make notes and you spend a lot of time doing it. But I only had a couple hours to work with in the past few days, so I didn't do it. So we'll start off with that, and, you know, wherever the conversation leads is where it leads. That's sort of the way the show works. So, fellows, welcome this evening.
Hi.
Yeah, good evening.
Now, I know, Jay, you've actually studied some of the primate behaviors and done some comparative anthropology, and TW, you have too, basically, since you're in college currently taking some coursework. I guess let's kind of talk about some of those things. I mean, we mentioned last week about using comparative anthropology, and I think that's very important. It's something you kind of have to do if you don't know much about an unknown species or an unrecognized species, but you know kind of the basic family they belong to. Sasquatch is obviously a primate. You know, everything that constitutes what a primate is, the Sasquatch has. So that's not even a question. They're definitely in the primate family. So we can reasonably assume that they're going to have similar to behaviors to other primate species.
Well, first of all, I'd like to start by saying that I'm not an anthropologist or a biologist, so, that I read a lot. So, I think the closest that we could get, you know, without actually having, you know, something to study, you know, in front of us, which we all kind of wish we did, at our own, under our own conditions, is to look at ourselves and then look at primates, you know, the closest that we can find, and figure out what those behavior traits are. I mean, if you're a purist in science, they say, you know, use of anthropometric language or anthropomorphic, I mean, language or an approach is taboo. You know, that you should be looking at strictly studying behaviors and not trying to superimpose, you know, human emotion or intent or thoughts or anything like that on whatever you're going to study. On the flip side of that coin, it's also been written that if we don't impart some sort of empathy to the subject that you're studying, then you lose the ability to learn about it and yourself. I think there's a fair amount of information out there already that suggests, we could coldly look at monkeys and apes and orangutans and things like that and say, you know, while they look a lot like us, so those similarities, you know, demand that they have thoughts and ideas and cares or emotions like we do. But we already have observed some of those things with great apes and with, you know, chimps in particular, where we know, and I think this goes back to some maybe primal instinct, but they've studied chimps in the wild and in captivity and shown that, you know, when they're begging for food, they do that with an open palm. There's been times when they would bare their teeth and hold their hand out, which, you know, we see that behavior in human beings. You know, we ask for things, we reach out, we put our open hand out, hey, give me this, you know, those types of things. They've seen female chimps shaking their head left, right, side to side, and imposing a negative emotion, or it's when, you know, they're trying to tell a little one, don't climb that tree, you know, or they're doing something that we perceive they don't want them to do, you know, maybe approaching a male that's agitated or something, and they've seen them shaking their head. So, you know, is that where we get that from? You know, it's not a learned behavior from them watching us when they study them and they see them doing this in the wild. So, you know, there's some things that I think you could draw some natural comparisons to.
Yeah, I think the difference go ahead.
No, that's all right. I was just going to say, one, you know, the fundamental question everybody says is, you know, where they come from, are they apes, are they not? You know, we say they're primates. Well, we're primates, you know, by the definition of the word. So if you look at what are the differences that separate us from great apes and chimps, you know, when it's already known that, you know, 97-98% of our mitochondrial DNA matches, there's only, what, a percent and a half left that differs, there are still differences. So what we think we understand based on you know, everybody that has, this is anecdotal reporting, unless you've, you know, had one screaming at you in the night, or you've seen one, or come face to face with it, you know, like TW. I haven't, I don't know if I would call the benefit of seeing one myself yet, but, you know.
You've been screamed at, though.
But I can tell you, I about crapped my pants when this thing was screaming at me, and I had a pretty good indication of what the heck it was, you know, as it's stomping away and everything. So, you know, I don't, anybody that knows me knows that it doesn't, you don't have to convince me. I know this is real, you know, this is, you know, to a lot of people, mythological creatures that they don't even want to get their mind around. I think there's some very primal things going on inside themselves where we have a fear of monsters. You know, we don't want to see things, think about things walking around our house at night that could rip your arms off and beat you to death, or, you know, break through the, you know, window and grab you out of your vehicle or whatever. And, you know, we don't want to think about those things, so we don't. We dismiss it. We put it in a box. But I think if you look at great apes and primates and chimps, and you look at their morphology, what makes them like they are and what makes us like we are, these fall squarely in between those two. I mean, they really do.
Yeah, morphology is what actually differentiates what different species are. In other words, if you take a look at the horse family, you know, you've got, you know, mules and zebras and all kinds of things that are different species, but they all fall within that same family. Same with primates. These guys, they have the same general makeup that all primates have, so that puts them, because it's based on morphology, squarely into the primate family. But I think when it comes to, there's a differentiation between, you know, anthropomorphism and comparative anthropology. Anthropomorphism, you're right, that's placing human emotions, thoughts, all these kinds of things on a non-human species, whereas, you know, comparative anthropology looks at, they say, okay, we've got this creature over here that's not recognized, but we're getting a lot of information, a lot of these reports, which, you know, TW is a police officer, you know, knows that that's trace evidence. It is anecdotal, but it's also trace evidence. When you look what's in those accounts, the behaviors, and you take that information to look and see with other primate species, let's say, you know, the Sasquatch, someone said it did A, B, and C, and you take a look at gorillas, and we find that there is A, B, and C behavior there. We look at chimps, there's A, B, and C behavior. I think it's fair to say at that point that's not anthropomorphism, that's comparative anthropology, because we can assume, since multiple other primate species do A, B, and C, and it was reported, let's say multiple unrelated witnesses with the Sasquatch, that A, B, and C was reported, I think, yeah, that's a reasonable comparison.
Well, you know, anthropomorphism says, you know, this is why they're doing this, or interpreting something that, like, you know, we smile, we bare our teeth. You know, if they're showing their teeth, that's probably not a good thing.
Right, you know? That's a challenge.
so that's the problem, is how far we go with that and what our interpretations of that behavior is. And oftentimes people misinterpret. There's been a lot of things written about gifting and the problems with gifting. And, you know, they experienced this with monkeys in China right now, where, you know, it's become a habit for tourists to go up there and carry things. Bag burglar is what they call these monkeys now, because they're very aggressive. So they'll look cute and they'll do the begging gesture because they've been conditioned to do that, but then they steal, you know. So they go right to, okay, I'm close enough, and then they take whatever they can get. So, you know, where the real response for that human interaction, which there probably shouldn't be anyway, but is to dominate. You know, is
right.
Show dominance and, you know, not offer anything, but, you know, so there,
or shoo them away or something, you know.
Yeah, I think it's a very fine line when people, you know, I hear about all these, you know, folks who see things are,
you know,
passive and, you know, we don't have any problems with them or anything. That subgroup you're dealing with may not right
That's
now.
Making an assumption.
Exactly.
And here's a direct correlation, and TW, you can relate to this because you've actually had an experience with this with these gentlemen that you've had contact with, where and it's something that's said pretty often, where when people leave things out for these things and then it stops, they get very aggressive.
They get pissy.
So, Jay, that's something, you know, we've seen, like you've seen this, you read this about with these monkeys in China, the Sasquatch. That's a comparative anthropology, you know, a direct correlation, you know, where we see what happens. And it's not just, you know, in China with, I mean, you can look in other parts of the world, South America. I mean, heck, grizzlies and black bears in Yellowstone got conditioned to people giving them food. And when they weren't getting it, they started pulling doors off cars and getting very aggressive and violent. And we hear stories of this all the time with the Sasquatch, whether food is being left out and then all of a sudden isn't available, or they're leaving food out for these things and it stops, then they get very aggressive.
Yeah, or they've heard about where there's a garden that they frequent. And here's one thing that I learned about primates that I wasn't really thinking about, and when you get into differentiation between human behavior and primate behavior, great apes. Humans have homesteads, and even if we're considered nomadic, we still carry our home with us—a tent, camper,
right?
Or something like that. We do that. Great apes don't. They don't have a home. They're always moving around. They're always building small nests.
Absolutely.
And things, so they remember where the food sources are. They remember to, you know, what types of food sources, when things are in bloom, fruit, you know, different things like that, and when to go to these areas. So, you know, my question for you would be, you know, how do you see these groups bonding together? Because that's one of the cultural questions I have. Because, you know, even chimps have culture, and you know, people might laugh at that or whatever, but you know, we know chimps are smart, we know great apes are smart, we know there have been you know, apes or primates in captivity that have learned up to 100 sign language, you know, words and sign language and gestures. They're aware enough to even be able to combine symbols that they were taught when they see something new. Like there was a female chimp that saw a swan and the first time said water bird, sign for water. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's more intellect there than I think we probably want to allude to, even in the wild.
Well, Jane Goodall makes that analogy.
Oh, definitely. I mean, a lot of mainstream science does not like Jane Goodall or I forget what the other woman's name was.
Dian Fossey.
Yeah, Dian Fossey. And that's because they of their descriptions. They did anthropomorphize their descriptions of them in the wild to engender them to people. And even Jane Goodall said that, you know, she did that purposely, because if you don't, you know, when it deals with conservation and care, that's the only way we want to care about something, if it looks somewhat similar to
sure.
it. If it looks like a crab or something, you know, and it's as big as we are, we're definitely not going to want to, you know, have anything to do with that. We could go, okay, wipe them all
right.
out, they're all gone. You know, but you know, it's a different situation. So, you know, I just, you know, these groups, you know, I was looking at the culture and how different social group patterns are developed. And in primates, whether it's, you know, you could apply this to humans, there's really six different types or groups. And they're single female and her offspring, so mother-daughter, mother-son, the monogamous family group, polyandrous family group, one male, several female group, and I'm reading this because I had to write a few of these things down today, multi-male and multi-female groups, and then the fission fusion society. And the fission fusion is more common, where they, you know, they get together, but they don't necessarily stay together. They, you know, female leave the group, go to another one looking for males, or a male may leave the group, you know, going to bond with other males to go hunt and eat, whatever.
Sure.
How do you see these social groups for these creatures? Because the majority that I hear are, and I'm jumping around here a little bit, but this is a problem that I saw with some, I guess, intelligence you'd call it, that was presented. It was some information presented by another organization that was on a study they were doing, and I was watching television.
Yeah, here's sort of the behaviors. Part of this has to do with the food supply because the areas they inhabit, you know, food, and this goes into their size and everything. They have to be the size they are to cover the ground they need to get the amount of food they need. So that's the reason the groups are kind of the size they are, typically 4 to 6 individuals. The groups, now let's say within a range, the ranges overlap. There can be, and I'll use the South Mount St. Helens area because there are 3 groups primarily in that 3,000 square mile area. 2 of the groups are 4-member groups. 1 of the groups is a 3-member group. Sometimes that group will split up, and it's probably 3 rogue males, you know, that don't really have, you know, mates or anything. So they'll occasionally, some of them will join with one of the other groups, and then they'll leave the groups. The groups are hierarchical. In other words, one of those groups is more dominant than the next, and so on. And occasionally they'll bond together for reasons unknown, but only for a relatively short time period. Then they go their ways again. They separate. If they were, let's say, a larger group, you know, like we do, they'd run out of food pretty quickly, and it would kind of thwart their hunting abilities because being in small numbers really favors these things, because the fewer numbers, they cover more of that ground in a feeding area, and they actually get more nutrition from that than trying to, I mean, you know, they would deplete an area too quickly and they'd be on the move too often. So,
well, that behavior
that's kind of how that works.
That behavior that you're describing directly overlaps with everything I've read about primates.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so it's the same type of thing. It depends on, you know, whether rhesus monkeys or whether they're orangutans or whether they're chimps. Orangutans tend to be more aggressive, and when you talk about vindictive or whatever, they, I don't know, there's a group of orangutans in Africa that they, and I'd have to look up the name of the place, but where they would go in and raid crops, and the local farmers, you know, the people that have to interact with these things daily, it's a negative interaction predominantly.
Right.
And they see them that way because they'll come in and it's premeditated. And that's they say that, mm-hmm. you know, chimps tend to be more opportunistic, but they call them there. They refer to them there as more human because they only take what they need to eat. You know, they mm-hmm. leave, you know, but orangutans tend to come in and they're more terrestrial, not necessarily, you know, tree-based. They're more ground-based creatures, but they come in and they have no fear of people and they raid and then they destroy the rest of the stuff that they're not going to eat, which is, you know.
These creatures, too, it could be the various types, are going to have some different behavioral characteristics, I think. And as of this point, I don't really know, you know, what separates them, you know, which one is worse than the others, other than, you know, if you go by reports, if there's enough information that, you know, can help you identify which type a particular individual or individuals
to do
are from,
with their
but
interaction with the locals and, you know, how that went and, you know, that sort of thing too. Because, you know, in Asia, you know, their culture and even in India, you know, they see these animals more godlike. You know, they do tend to treat them differently and things, but, you know, in Africa, not necessarily.
Example from India, I've talked to a couple different guys. One of them is actually, well, actually, they're both JRG members now. One of them has a working relationship with, you know, what they call Bollywood. He's a New Zealander that lives in northern India and works with that business. So he has, you know, he knows a lot of the locals. He's been there a long time. And we were talking not long ago about the tiger population. He was telling me about the tiger population making a big comeback, more so than people think. And about the Indian military and their special forces, and apparently their special forces are pretty good. He says they're on par with ours, probably trained by ours. But there are places, you know, they go in and take care of the poachers. They take care of the poachers that kill tigers and everything. So, and they're pretty relentless, I guess, and brutal. So the locals, when it comes to the Yeti, that's a whole different thing. Of course, the locals, you know, human life isn't valued very high in India because there's so many people there. A lot of people, of course, get taken by tigers and other means of, you know, death. But so it's not looked into very hard, you know, when somebody comes up missing and somebody says, hey, you know, a tiger got him or whoever. But apparently when the Yetis take people a lot, and they said that the locals are more fearful of the Yeti by far than they are the tiger, and the Indian Special Forces won't go anywhere near the places where the Yetis are. But it, I don't know about the vindictive part of that, you know, when it comes to, I mean, that's a feeding behavior, but there's more of an example. Now, we know the Sasquatch has kind of a short temper. I mean, we can see that in lots and lots of reports, lots of stories. And I'm thinking of one, and I wish I interviewed the guy for the show a few years back. He was in North Carolina at the time, I believe it was, and he talked about some of the local communities where he was working. And apparently, for unknown reasons, one of these things was vindictively killing off livestock. Cows, horses, sheep, pigs. Typically, it would bite them through the back of the neck, break their spine, and then leave them very close to the person's home, almost like, you know, it wanted them to know that it was killing their livestock. And TW, tell us about the picture you had with the dead sheep, because I think that's
that
a good
goat.
Example.
Yeah, in South Central Texas. A lady sent me a picture wanting to know if this was a mountain lion kill. And the more we went over it, I said, you know, mountain lions, they're not going to kill something right there within eyeshot of your house. It was just a couple hundred yards from the woman's house.
And it was drugged towards the house, right?
And the left front leg was totally dislodged and dismembered from the body. The goat was dead. I mean, it was graveyard dead, but it was like within an eye shot of the house. So,
yeah, that kind of reminded me of what the guy told me about in North Carolina, because it wasn't particularly eating the animals. I mean, it did take some and eat them, but more often than not, it was simply killing livestock and leaving them where people would find them close by, almost to say, hey, I'm here, I'm doing this, too bad.
Pretty much. And there's other stories out there about vindictive behavior where a guy that was in the military, this is during Desert Storm time frame, had went to Desert Storm, and him and his grandfather were unknowingly habituating a troop of Bigfoot. Well, as he's off to war, his grandfather ends up having a heart attack and going to the hospital. Well, by the time he got out of the hospital and got home, he had a herd of goats, and they were all killed. They were just laying out there in the field dead, and all of them had their necks snapped. Yeah, they get vindictive.
Nothing, neck snapped.
Just, I mean, like 30 dead goats out in the field. And that was the thing, is that they would feed these Bigfoot dog food and sweet feed. And then, of course, when Grandpa got sick and had to go to the hospital, nobody was there to leave him food. And he was in the hospital a couple of weeks. And when he got back, all his goats were dead.
Yeah, they got angry because the food was gone.
With other predators sometimes too, that, and you know, these are apex, but you know, where sometimes they'll kill as more of a training thing, you know, where they learn to how to perfect a kill, and you know, they might find pets or other things that, you know, have been taken but not eaten by certain animals. But you know, down at in Foley, I kept in contact with those folks, and you know, well, we just got pictures, you know, the window that was broken shortly after. And so, you know, I got a hold of those folks and same thing, and said, you know, matter of fact, I just today, and they said it's been fairly quiet. I said, well, you know, maybe we got lucky and they moved on. But if not, I would still, you know, be very cautious about what you're doing around there, because the TW, what happened was these folks had a lot of activity on their property. And I went down there to kind of check it out and you know, look at some of the evidence they had things and kind of had something happen that I couldn't really rationalize. You know, I heard, you know, honestly, all the times I've heard it before, recordings and everything, I thought it was kind of BS, this samurai chatter, deep guttural, you know, like two people talking, but low enough where you can't hear it, and it sounds like, you know, gibberish almost.
Yeah.
Heard that, and then two little ones come running right at us, and one cut to the left, and the other one came straight at us, and the guy I'm standing there with, you know, happened to speak out right about then, I think out of nervousness, and, you know, it stopped immediately, and the other one backpedaled into the wood, and we couldn't see anything. The foliage was so thick. But right after that visit, somebody clear cut that whole property on the other side of the woods on the other side of their pond, almost up to their pond. And, you know, that was not a very big greenway, but it followed this intermittent stream that led to the pond, and there's a natural spring right there at the end of their pond, too. So, you know, these things may have been coming there over and over again. It was a food source, a source of fresh water, you know, they whatever. And of course, these folks had bush hogged the field between the pots. They found bedding spots out there. He turned around, looked through his window, and saw one standing across the fence that was, you know, 20 yards away, you know, one of the big ones and stuff before. And, you know, they were like, okay, now what I know this is, you know, so he wanted some standoff between his house and the pond. Well, you bush hog all the property down to the woods, and now a bunch of woods is missing. You know, they might come back and not appreciate that very much, you know. Where they think that it's actually these folks.
That was probably their avenue of approach.
You know? And instead of, you know, they don't realize, you know, they don't care who took the woods. It's just people did. You know, they changed it.
Well, wasn't that the issue with Patty, that they figured that was why they ended up having so many sightings in that Bluff Creek area?
Well, you know, that area had a long history. When I interviewed Al Hodgson, and this was, you know, he said his family moved to Willow Creek back in the mid-1920s. That was something, and this was long, many, many, many years before there were any kind of roads over into that country. You know, they always talked about people hearing the apes scream across the river, you know, across the Klamath River over there. And they did start logging in there in the late 1950s, but, you know, I don't know if that really caused any issues. What it did cause, it was after a decade of intrusion by people in there, the things finally bugged out of the area and quit coming in there.
That's the issue that they've been having in you know, far east, deep east Texas, is that Greenbelt area, the Big Piney, certain swaths of land they cut down the timber, and then it's just, I mean, it's barren for miles.
And, you know, it's one way to drive these things out of an area. And we know this. It's one of the things, you know, we advise people of, and I got this from inside contacts, is if they start coming up, like the people in, you know, Tammy and James, if they've got stuff coming right up to their house, one of the questions I ask people, do you have brush that grows right up to your house? Usually they say yes, and we tell them to cut it back at least 50 feet. And that's one of the things that deters these things from coming up to a house. For some reason, they don't like to come out in the open and approach a house. For good reason, because, you know, they know people are dangerous. That's something that's probably an instinct with them. So, you know, if they've got a concealed route to come in. Same with these large areas, these green belts. If they're cut back, and I'm sure whoever's in charge of handling all this stuff, they're probably well aware of that. If they get rid of that space, it alters the behaviors. There's other things like a lot of vehicular traffic that will move them out of an area also. You know, they sort of have to have free rein, you know, sort of things their way to come into an area to exhibit all these sorts of behaviors. But if certain particulars are removed, it'll change the dynamics, yeah, and they'll leave an area.
Well, and that's that has always been one of my, for lack of a better term, fallbacks, is that if the area is disturbed so dramatically, it's like any other animal. They're going to leave.
Yeah, they might let you know if they don't like it before they leave.
Exactly. Absolutely. And in, like, going back to the Bluff Creek thing, once that Sasquatch was filmed, there were all kinds of people crawling all over that place, you know, looky-loos and investigators and so on. You know, from that time forward, you know, if that was an area that I was coming in to feed occasionally, and they were only coming in there about every 2 to 3 years, I think I'd move somewhere else a little more suitable, away from, you know, those pesky humans,
exactly,
that we don't like anyway.
Well, and that's the thing, you know, it's on the apex predator scale, we're really at the top of the scale. Not because we're massively stronger or massively built. It's because we tend to it's kind of like velociraptors. They hunted in packs. Well, so do we. And we tend to be extremely violent. And that's the one. Thing I tell everybody, you know, when they throw a skeptical eye at it, and that's fine. You know, skepticism's good. One fellow student that said, you know, we got enough Bubbas in this country. They, you know, enough rednecks. They should have killed one by now. And I said, okay, look at it like this. Why would a creature that exhibits a certain amount of intelligence that is a, for lack of a better term, a savant in the wilderness setting, they know how to stay concealed, they know how to hunt quietly. Why would they want to even be around us or anywhere near us to where we do get a shot at them, because we're extremely violent? They don't know.
And Jay, yeah, what that brings up a good point. And it sort of ties into something Jay said earlier about, you know, we have this innate fear of the dark and what might be out there. And personally, I think that goes back to early humans' interaction with these things. You know, the Sasquatch is the boogeyman that we fear.
I watched a movie the other day called Boggy Creek, The Beast of Boggy Creek. It was just named Boggy Creek. Now, granted, it was a fictionalized movie. And for all intents and purposes, the acting really sucked. But at the end of the movie, the lone survivor in this group is sitting in this clearing, and she looks up, and there's a Sasquatch standing right there. And it roared, and out of the wood line come like 20 of them. Never even knew that they were there. You know, the premise that, and I tell investigators in my district, don't go in by yourself. You go in two or three strong.
You know, one of the biggest problems I have with this is that we think we're almost aloof in our perceptions of ourselves. How Absolutely. We perceive our environment today, we have convinced ourselves, and I think through the media and everything else, that, you know, because we've got internet, because we have technology and all this stuff, that we know everything there is to know about everything. I fly, you know, so I'll take someone up in a plane here locally, and immediately they say, wow, I didn't realize there was that much woods around here. Because what do? We drive down an interstate or a highway, and it's cut back on either side, and we go from our populated area to our populated area. We go to work, and we stop at Walmart, and we come home. You know, we're not today walking through the woods and living in the woods after dark like people did 200 years ago.
It's been a superb marketing job, you know, to convince everyone that this is our reality. This is the reality that human beings have made for ourselves and the planet. Everybody that's sort of, you know, in urbanized areas for the most part, and even some outside of that, really kind of buy into that. And as each generation successive one comes along, they're more and more entrenched into that thought. And it's not reality.
What I was going to say, too, though, is that they also immediately impart that this is just a dumb animal in the woods. If you live in wilderness in Colorado, or you live in eastern Texas, or if you live somewhere in the Rockies where there's, you know, a real threat potential for, you know, mountain lion and black bear or grizzly, you're probably not going to go out in the woods without a weapon, without a sidearm. And if you did,
that's right,
someone's going to look at you like, you are stupid. You know, the general population that's used to that is going to look at you like you're the crazy one. But if you go to the East Coast, you know, some city guy, and you talk to them, they're not thinking about that stuff. Oh, I'm going to go spend a day in the woods, walk around some trails, you know, do whatever. It's whatever. If you talk to people who are in areas that are frequented by these things, it is a known. There is no doubt in their mind. They've either had encounters themselves. They have family members that have been telling stories, you know, their whole lives. A neighbor, you know, if you go to these areas, it's beyond folklore. And I think it's interesting that we can look at, you know, animals that we know, orangutans, for example, like this group. And I looked it up. It's actually in Bunyoro Kingdom, Uganda. But these orangutan groups post sentries in trees to watch for farmer patrols, and then they actually set diversions so that purposely so they get the guard's attention, so that others in the group can travel through there unnoticed. You know, there's intelligence.
Right, and we know the Sasquatch uses sentries also.
You know, these creatures are exponentially more intelligent than, you know, orangutans and, you know, potentially great apes, you know? So when we already see measurable intelligence in these animals that we you know, take as day-to-day animals now, even though they are still fairly rare, you know, and then we try and superimpose, you know, that this thing is dumb as my dog, you know, out in the woods, you know.
And that's yet to get another parallel or comparative behavior, you know, for orangutans, and I'm sure chimps do it, and other apes also post sentries. We know the Sasquatch does too. They discovered that from my own field work, but that's definitely...
Counter, I think that may exactly be what that was. You know, it was right at a creek crossing and a gravel road, you know. It was, you know, 11 o'clock at night, you know, during their hunting cycle. That may have been a sentry.
And you're not only the enemy, you're also marking its territory.
Can we talk for just a second about biology, too? Because they're, you know, reading into, you know, some of these things about primates, you know, the different types, macaques, rhesus monkeys and different things. You know, gorillas are very different than chimpanzees. Chimpanzees tend to be a lot more social, spread out in an area, larger groups, you know, those things. Gorillas tend to be a lot more isolated and things. So when these groups are isolated, like you, and this pretty much correlates to what you talked about before about, you know, the size of the animal, the food sources available, not necessarily creating pressures for other subgroups for their own survival. Not that they're thinking about doing that, but it's just part of, you know, what happens. But they tend to be animals that then can, when they get on the boundary of their areas, vocalize. So, you know, you've got, you know, we have the ability for speech, and they already know that the physiology in apes and chimps are limited, so they can't form complex speech or words, but they can learn constructs of words and meanings and putting things together, and even deceitfulness, you know, which is interesting. But what I heard, you know, and I've heard this over and over again, I mean, created so much power. I mean, it was a very percussive, shake your insides kind of thing, you know. That's an animal that needs to broadcast over a vast distance.
And they do, and they cover such huge chunks of land, and all that's in their benefit.
So, you know, we hear the howls and the yells, you know, these things, you know, and you know, we say, well, you know, that's because it may be a solitary creature out there, whatever, but, you know, that speaks more to, you know, maybe these small subgroups that may potentially avoid each other until a time when they just
absolutely
don't.
And like I mentioned earlier, the different groups, there will be a hierarchy between the groups. In other words, one group will be more dominant than another one, and that all goes into survival. I mean, it sort of keeps them from, you know, fighting and potentially dying when they don't need to, if they simply maintain their space by letting another group know that they're in the area. There was a report I got a while back where there was, you know, a lot of this vocalizing, and it sounded by the witnesses, you know, as if there were two groups of chimps, you know, making all this racket back and forth, and then suddenly apparently one of the alphas got involved and roared, and then it went silent, and the two groups simply went their own ways. And that's something you see in other primate groups also, you know, where you know, initial encounters will be, there'll be a lot of ruckus, a lot of noise, a lot of posturing. It's what they do. It's the whole reason for the lip flip. It's a challenge, you know, to show you that, hey, I've got bigger teeth than you. You know, you don't want to fight me. Stay away. So all that noise and ruckus, and then when the dominant male of what the dominant group apparently steps up and makes this display, then that's it. It's the contest is decided, and they simply, you know, pass without any sort of altercation. You know, it satisfies the dominance issue, and it also keeps everybody safe.
Yeah, they, you know, primates tend to be not accepting of outsiders.
Exactly, and we're a good example
right.
of that.
Yeah, and we think we're culturally advanced, civil, right?
Right. We lost TW. I think maybe he hasn't messaged me, so maybe he had to leave. But we'll carry on. But yeah, you're right. I mean, you can look at human history. We're, you know, a really prime example of that. And even with other groups of chimps, so I mean, you can look on YouTube. There are videos up there of you know, chimps warring between themselves. You know, where for whatever reason, whether it's territory, food, mates, whatever, but sometimes, and a lot of times, chimps will even attack an individual from another band, and they'll kill them and eat them.
Yeah, form war parties, and, you know, males will go along with it to establish relationships, you know, amongst their own.
You know, it's funny, I watched a film when I was in college many years ago. They were talking about, and they showed us a film with these chimps, and the researchers were out there, they'd established, you know, their presence with this particular band of chimps. I think there were 15 or 20 animals in the group. And they identified, you know, each of the males and their place in the hierarchy, but they were always testing, you know, to see, you know, jockeying for position. Kind of sounded like the military. You know, everybody's always jockeying for position, you know, to move up one step. Then the researchers did a test. You know, it's always whoever's, you know, makes is bigger, can look bigger. That's why when you see them open their arms up and do things like that, they make themselves look bigger, and the screaming, you know, and they thrash brush and things like that. One of the researchers took this metal 5-gallon can and put it in the place where they would gather every day. And one of the lesser males that was kind of way down the list grabbed this can and started rolling it, making a whole bunch of noise. Well, it scared the hell out of the other males. So all of a sudden, this lesser male, and he was, I mean, way down the hierarchy list, became the dominant male of the group. It was interesting how just weird, you know, things like that. But part of that, you know, when it comes to that, those displays and that kind of behavior, and again, that's one of those comparative anthropology things. You know, when you look at you know, chimps, for example, you know, grabbing brush and thrashing it back and forth. There's been plenty of accounts where witnesses talk about the Sasquatch doing that. And I'll give you an example. I interviewed a guy back in 1992. He told me that he was a former Hell's Angels member, and him and a buddy of his in the motorcycle group were going to Southern Oregon to look for the Port Orford meteor. So they rode to Southern Oregon, out towards the coast to look for where this meteor had been reported going down, you know, decades before, thinking they were going to make a lot of money from it. So they made their camp that evening. While they were sitting around the fire, they heard this noise up on the ridge above them, and they thought it was a person up there. So the noise kept getting, and I can't remember if it, I think it was a vocalization. Periodically, as this individual was coming down the ridge in the dark, it would scream or make this noise. And then suddenly, it pops out of the tree line, maybe 30 feet from where their fire was. And there were sapling trees there, and it grabbed a couple of them and was just thrashing it back and forth and making this huge ruckus. And, you know, from his description, of course, they both instinctively, they thought they were on the menu. They grabbed their 30-30s and each put a round in his chest, and it screeched and took off. But, you know, that display was exactly like what you see chimps doing. You know, it was probably coming down there, challenging them, you know, making itself like it needed to make itself look bigger, but there were two men and one of it. So, and again, that goes back to, you know, probably the prehistoric relationship between humans and these things, which I don't believe was very good. So if it's a numbers game, you know, one Sasquatch, two or more people, it would need to make itself look bigger and better.
I felt like that's what I was witnessing. Well, one, I'm peeing on the ground marking its territory, but, you know, it was a...
Exactly.
It was a vocal display of power. I mean, to say, look how loud I can scream, and letting you know I've hit limbs, yeah, breaking branches. I mean, it was like, yeah, like a big ruckus, you know, throat was just pounding away.
Yeah, and it wasn't trying to move away quietly like they typically do. It was making itself well known.
Let me know how big and powerful this thing was, and I got the heck out of it.
So that's exactly that same kind of display.
You know, you see that, and it's like there are just so many comparisons, you know, to this. So
That's what I say. I think if we use, which is what our goal is to use comparative anthropology, we can pretty much figure out a lot more than has been done previously about these things. A lot of people, like you were bringing up some good points earlier, these groups, you know, it's more about what they think and feel than comparing to what we do know to something we don't know.
You know, there are footprint tests. There are, you know, there's thousands and thousands of witness reports.
There's a lot of trace evidence.
The physical descriptions that I'm getting from folks around here and stuff too, all kind of describe two different creatures, but one is more man-sized and the other one is, you know, the big muscular 8-9 foot tall, you know, sort of thing. Those tend to look more human in the face. The other ones look more monkey in the face.
Yeah.
But when you draw comparisons just straight up between great apes and humans, the big differences, likenesses are, we both have 32 teeth. We both have multiple tongues, those things. But what we diverge, mm-hmm, when it comes to, you know, all these primates have prehensile feet too. Well, you know, these creatures don't.
Right.
You know, some have more of a divergent big toe, you know, in some of the casts and things, but more common with primates than us is the flat footedness, wide foot to carry the weight. You know, what I've heard about, you know, studied bipedal locomotion when they talked about doing the comparisons with the patty film and the way people have seen these things move. Where we can lock our knee, mm-hmm, they apparently can't. You know, things like that are right in between right now that predominantly lock our knees.
Right.
You know, we've got a wider hip.
And the interesting thing with that is we're actually, right, and we're relatively newcomers to the primate scene. Sorry about that.
We've got, you know, pretty much twice the brain capacity than most apes do, so that's a difference, you know. But then if you drop, you know, this creature right in between those two, it lines right up with the physiology differences between them. You know, I think that's what would be extremely interesting is you know, looking at their, what kind of vocal cords they must have, lung capacity, you know, the size of their brain. I mean, it's I'm not going to say that one hasn't been taken. I don't know, you know, but if they do have one and someone's studying it, you know, what a job that is.
Well, all I can tell you is my source that I call Mr. Black, and he's been pretty spot on with all his information, told me once that he knows one particular scientist he knows had dissected at least two of them. And when he described, he said what he told him was, in terms of vocal cords, they had what looked like two sets of vocal cords, the purpose of, you know, which they didn't know. So, I mean, there were some interesting details that you couldn't just make up. I mean, it was stuff that, and he actually gave me enough information to verify who he is and his background. So
if you look at what great apes do have, you know, chimps and macaques, mm-hmm, and things that have the power to vocalize way beyond human range, you know, in volume and range.
Right.
And then look at what humans have. If these fall in between those, it would make, mm-hmm, sense that they would either have some combined capability or you know, some morphology.
Or some sort of a different structure, maybe.
Lends itself to, you know, living in both environments, you know, so.
If I had my guess, I would say these guys are probably in the hominid family, which would differentiate them from apes. That's why there would be so much of a different structure. You know, it wasn't that many eons ago that we weren't like we are currently, that we were more, you know, hair-covered and ape-like. And they still don't know, you know, why we developed the way we did.
Yeah, that
Danny Vendramini.
I think that anyone that can get their hands on that and read it, you know, it reads like a doctoral thesis for sure. But it, I think that does proposes a very compelling argument
it's pretty interesting, isn't it?
The science behind it and you know, what environmental pressures lead, you know, that sort of thing. So.
Mm-hmm. And it would certainly explain our behavior since that time. I mean, you know, the violent nature that we have. I mean, the one constant in human history is warfare. It's the one thing that has been always present. You know, forms of government, things like that come and go. But when it comes to our vicious aggressiveness towards everything and each other, it makes you wonder about the cause of that. I mean, it's almost like there was an external force that did so ingrain that in us, it almost made it a necessity for our survival.
Well, and that's what he poses, is that, you know, when if early hominids were driven to near extinction by, you know, Neanderthal raids, and that we were predated by those beings, that there would be a necessity to be able to identify the differences, you know.
And my guess again would be that it wasn't Neanderthal, it was actually these creatures that caused that. And it even to this very day explains the interaction between humans and these things, why they stay away from us so much.
That's the hypothesis, really.
I think that at one point in our history that we thought we... Yeah, I think at one point in our history we believed that we exterminated.
And they have found both bones mixed. And they know that Neanderthals buried their own, cared about their own, but didn't care about us.
Exactly.
Because they found early hominid bones in the pile of their kills, you know, with deer bones and whatever else they had there.
Right.
Yeah, discarded like
just
like
discarded
nothing. So they know that, you know, there was something going on there, that for at least 10,000 years there was some interaction. And you know, the guy that wrote that paper, you know, I mean, goes, tells you exactly where they found these things and has it all documented.
And it's interesting how what he had the artist do with the reconstruction on the skull. It's always interested me, you know, they for years they always made Neanderthals out to look like a really ugly human, when in fact, you know, the method they use on that, so that when we find a human, a Homo sapien skeleton, we can do a pretty good reconstruction. Because something with a different species, they don't know all that, so they were making assumptions that might have been completely off, whereas his artist... Now, I think the eyes are wrong. You know, I understand why he made the assumptions that he did, but, you know, when you look at the reconstruction, it's that would have been a pretty frightening thing. And I'll tell you, I've had a lot of eyewitnesses tell me that was the closest... You know, we had the eyes and the nose changed on that artwork, and many people have told me that is the closest rendition to what they saw that they've ever seen. The only difference is being minor with some hair placement. But other than that, they say that's what they saw.
What frustrates me is, you know, you run into like three different types of people. You run into the person that says, you know, hey, that's interesting, maybe. And then you run into, well, maybe four types. But then you run into the person who is like, oh, that's a bunch of crap, immediately. You know, now doesn't, negative, not going to.
Right.
And isn't even willing to pose questions or say, okay, well, let's entertain this idea, you know, and yeah, they just immediately...
They're just closed-minded.
And I think that's striking something in them to where they don't want to. So it would change their reality. It would, you know...
I think it also goes back to that primal fear that these things might be the source of. I mean, there's a lot of things in our psyche, conflict.
You know, a lot of people who are probably closer to primal than others. Cuban.
Yeah, well, this is true.
And then the other ones that frustrate me are the people, and I fall in this category sometimes, is who enter, you know, well, okay, you've got, you know, the people who know. I mean, if you've had this thing stand in front of you, you know, if you, whatever. But let's just say you haven't, mm-hmm. and they're willing to entertain the idea. Then you've got that group that
right.
suddenly, you know, every sound is a Sasquatch, or, you know, every bit of data is valid, you know, and just as dangerous. So,
right.
you know, I got frustrated because, you know, in the military, you know, we did some intelligence work and stuff, so there's different tools to use to develop patterns and whatnot. And it's pretty easy to apply these things, but you know, I was watching one of these shows, and there was a doctor on there, and he said, you know, look what I did. I took all of these patterns of activity, and I plotted all these dots, all the map, and, you know, it's in these mountainous ranges, and, you know, during this time of the year, they come down to here, and this time of the year, they're here, and all this, and this is all based off of reporting. And he said, you know, this is Sasquatch behavior, Bigfoot behavior, you know, take it to the bank. And I thought, no, that's human behavior. You know, where are you getting your information from? You know, your source
yeah, exactly.
data is coming from humans who are in that environment at that time. What were they doing there? All you're doing is building a pattern of human behavior at that time at those elevations. Now you can, you know, say that those do cross, you know, that if they had an encounter, well, then that creature was there at that time or whatever, and there's a correlation, but you can't just chalk it up to say, you know, this is what they were doing at that time.
And there's the people that a lot of them like, you know, on our Facebook page the other day, there was a guy, he posted a picture of a forest setting, and he claimed that there was a shadow that was a Bigfoot, and there was lots of discussion on it, and I didn't see anything in the picture. I mean, it wasn't really worth my time looking at it. It was kind of a distant shot of some trees, and the guy was making all sorts of claims, and he circled a shadow and said, now do you see it? And a friend of mine that's he used to be part of my field teams back in the 90s, who is Sioux Indian and a pretty good tracker, he's pretty dry sense of humor, but when you know what he's Dan's sense of humor is like, he's pretty funny. And at one point, he was part of the conversation. He says, oh, yeah, up in the corner, there was some fog or something in part of the picture. He says, I see the Bigfoot up there sending smoke signals. And the guy all of a sudden, he says, oh, yeah, I saw that, too. You know, he was serious about it. And then my buddy Dan calls me immediately afterwards, was laughing about it. He says, geez, I was just pulling the guy's leg. You know, but like you said, you know, there's so many people that they want to believe this
paranoia.
Junk.
And it's something that, you know, you can be yeah. sitting in your bathroom looking at the floor tiles and seeing faces in the tile, you know, or looking at wood knots in a wooden door.
Yeah, and there's a little bit of insanity in that. You know, when I was taking my psych courses at WSU, they talked about that yeah. sort of thing. It's like the Rorschach test. Everybody always says, well, what are you supposed to see in a Rorschach test? And the correct answer is you're not supposed to see anything.
Well, whether someone is more in tune to trying to please the person that's lending the question, or you know, are they answering? You know, where do they stand in this? You know, it's,
right.
but yeah, I mean, it's very easy to, you know, there's pictures of, like, there was a blackbird, I think, that was flying in front of a camera, and somebody got a picture of it, and it looked like this big black blob back in the bushes, but actually, a bird flying in front of the camera
mm-hmm.
and the motion blur and everything made it just look like it was back in the bushes or whatever. So, you know, a lot of things can be explained. And I think we need to keep, you know, a high level of skepticism with what we're doing.
Because when you were in Alabama recently, yeah, you and I have the same outlook. When you were in Alabama recently, you know, and you guys heard the mumbling, and then the two little ones, you actually wanted to go right directly to the spot and see what was there. I'm the same way. If I see or hear something, I'm going to go charging in there to see what's there. I don't want to, you know, take a picture of some brush and say, oh, well, I want to back it up.
And when I was trying to use the camera just before it got dark, it wouldn't work. And I swear to God, people keep saying it. And you know, I've heard recordings of the mumbling and all that stuff, and I thought it's a bunch of hogwash. I don't know that I'd buy that. And the only reason is because I didn't personally experience that. So, am I a hypocrite? Yeah, probably.
Right, right.
But you still have to kind of keep that in your head until something validates that, you know, this is going on right now. And, of course, you don't want to put eyes on, so I'm going to go trudging right out there and look. But, it, you know, it's dumb because it would be the last thing I ever do.
Right.
But, you know, but...
Well, listen, Jay, we're running out of time. Thanks for joining us this week. We're going to continue the discussion next week. TW got kicked off the line and wasn't able to come back on, so he's having some computer issues. So with the same folks, maybe an additional one. Maybe I can get one of our scientists on, too. Maybe we can get Mark Dobbs on. He's our forensic anthropologist. But check out the website, williamjebning.com. If you haven't subscribed yet, go to Podbean and sign up for Witness of the Unknown. It's my one-on-one interviews with Sasquatch eyewitnesses. Thanks for joining us this week, folks.